Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, October 12th, 2025. Nobel Prize season is here. Every October, committees in Sweden and Norway name laureates in a variety of prizes related to science, literature, and economics, as well as peace work. Six prizes in total are awarded. This past week, five of those were. The laureates received their Nobel Prize medals and diplomas in Stockholm, Sweden, in December. Here is a quick guide to the prizes. First, what are they? Six Nobel Prizes are awarded every year, each recognizing an individual's or an organization's groundbreaking contribution in a specific field. Prizes are given for physiology or medicine, physics, chemistry, economic science, literature, and peace work, the last of which often draws the most attention because of the fame of the people and groups nominated. When are the awards announced? One prize is announced each day from October 6th to October 10th, with one more on October 13th, tomorrow, between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. Eastern Time. Announcements are made mainly from Oslo and Stockholm and are streamed live on the official digital channels of the Nobel Prize Organization. Monday was the Physiology or Medicine Award. The award for physics was announced last Tuesday. The award for chemistry was announced on Wednesday. Tomorrow, the award for economic sciences will be announced. What do the laureates receive? Nobel Prize laureates will receive a diploma, a medal, and a document detailing the Nobel Prize amount, which this year is set to be about 1.17 million in current exchange rates. If more than one scientist wins in any category, the award is divided among the winners. The Nobel Prize for Medicine was awarded for discoveries about the immune system. A Japanese immunologist and two American scientists shared the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for fundamental discoveries about how the immune system keeps itself in check, preventing itself from attacking and destroying the body's cells. The winners were Mary E. Brunko, a senior program manager at the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle, Fred Ramstel, an immunologist and co-founder of Sonoma Biotherapeutics in San Francisco, and Shimon Sakaguchi, an immunologist at Osaka University in Japan. This year's prize is for fundamental research about a basic question intricately connected to human health. How does the immune system fight a vast repertoire of external pathogens and diseases, but not mistakenly attack our own cells? Human health hinges on this delicate balance, and when it goes awry, it can have harmful results, as happens in type 1 diabetes, where the immune system destroys insulin-producing cells, or in rheumatoid arthritis. The laureate's work shed light on a class of immune cells called regulatory T cells, which the Nobel Committee compared to security guards for the immune system. While the work has not directly led to therapies yet, it helps illuminate principles of how the immune system works that could be harnessed to explore new therapies for autoimmune diseases. This Nobel Prize demonstrates how immunology is central to medicine and human health. The ability to harness, modulate, or restrain immune responses holds promise across a vast range of diseases, from autoimmune conditions to cancer, allergies, infectious diseases, and beyond, Ulrich von Andrian, president of the American Association of Immunologists, said in a statement. This summary from the Washington Post, updated on October 6, 2025. On Tuesday, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences awarded the 2025 Nobel Prize in Physics jointly to John Clark, Michelle H. Devoray, and John M. Martinez for the discovery of macroscopic quantum mechanical tunneling and energy quantization in an electric circuit. The much-loved UW collaborator John Clark is a professor emeritus of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, but he collaborates with the Axion Dark Matter Experiment at the University of Washington. ADMX scans for evidence of dark matter from beneath the Seattle campus in a cold, dark box surrounded by a powerful magnetic field. The experiment is managed by the U.S. Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, and it hinges on technology designed by Clark. I was elated upon hearing the news about John, simply elated, said Leslie Rosenberg, a University of Washington professor emeritus of physics and lead scientist at ADMX. The three laureates were recognized for experiments conducted in 1984 and 1985 that captured two quantum mechanical properties at the visible scale. Clark's brainchild, which caught Rosenberg's attention 25 years ago, is a superconducting quantum interference device, or SQUID for short, which can make ultra-sensitive measurements. John Clark first got involved with ADMX around 2000, Rosenberg recalled. To this day, he remains a much-loved ADMX collaborator. The relationship began when ADMX organized a workshop at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory to brainstorm solutions to a technical issue the researchers had encountered. The way the experiment searches for dark matter is akin to a radio searching for a station, but instead of music, it is looking for axions, the particles theorized to make up dark matter. Detecting axions requires amplifying very, very quiet microwaves. At the time, the group only had access to noisy electronic amplifiers, which were drowning out the very signal they sought to capture. At the workshop, Clark presented a SQUID amplifier as a potential solution. We considered all kinds of alternative technologies, but none fit the bill, Rosenberg said. The SQUID amplifiers were indeed the breakthrough we needed. Clark joined ADMX and brought the amplifiers with him. Gray Ripka, a UW professor of physics and co-spokesperson for ADMX, was a postdoc at the time. The SQUID amplifiers gave us the sensitivity necessary to do a search, he said. We've been operating for years and years and have only explored a fraction of the space, but we couldn't have even started without these amplifiers. ADMX is still using an iteration of Clark's original amplifier, improved upon by his students over the years. Still, the big transition was moving to a SQUID amplifier, and that is just one example of how this technology can revolutionize an experiment. The laureates moved the field of particle physics from classical measurement to quantum sensing, Ripka said. It makes stuff that used to just be on the blackboard, quantum mechanics, experimentally accessible and even useful. In my opinion, you wouldn't have modern quantum computers without the work done by this group. And this article appeared in the University of Washington News, posted on October 8, 2025. On Wednesday, October 8th, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to architects of metal organic frameworks. Susumu Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar M. Yagi were awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the development of molecular building blocks with spaces large enough that gases and other chemicals can flow through them. The cavities on the inside are almost like rooms in a hotel, so that guest molecules can enter and also exit again from the same material, Heiner Linke, chair of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry, said during the announcement of the award. The laureate's discoveries, he added, paved the way for the creation of materials that can separate toxic chemicals from wastewater or harvest water molecules in a desert. The laureate's work started with experiments by Dr. Robson in the 1980s and gradually developed over a period of about 15 years. It takes time for science to be recognized, and it takes multiple workers in the field with different approaches, said Dorothy Phillips, president of the American Chemical Society. The scientists are responsible for developing a new kind of molecular structure that combine metals and organic molecules. Dr. Linka likened the structure to the handbag used by the character Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter series. The bag looks small on the outside, but has space on the inside to fit larger stuff. The scientists' experiments laid the foundation for the development of thousands of metal organic structures with many real-world applications, like trapping gas emitted by fruit so it ripens more slowly. It has sparked a whole field, said Kim Jelfs, a computational chemist at Imperial College London. There's an enormous number of people that work in this area now, she said. In chemistry, molecules arrange themselves in unpredictable structures. The scientists were able to combine metals and organic molecules as building blocks so that even if the size of the clusters change, you would still get the same structure but with larger cavities inside, Dr. Jelf said. That level of control within chemistry has always been a challenge, she said. So that's part of the excitement. A bit more about the winners. Richard Robson is a professor at the University of Melbourne in Australia, where he has taught since 1966. Susumu Kitagawa received his PhD in 1979 from Kyoto University in Japan, where he now teaches. At a news conference by Kyoto University, he said he learned about the prize while finishing some work in his classroom. He said he'd been getting many sales calls on his phone recently, and so he answered the phone in a bad mood, quote unquote. But during the prize announcement, he said he was surprised and delighted at having been selected by the committee. I want to share my joy with the other two, he said of Dr. Robson and Dr. Yagi. Omar M. Yagi received his PhD from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He was born to Palestinian refugees who settled in Jordan and moved to New York for college, first at Hudson Valley Community College in Troy. He switched to the State University of New York at Albany in 1983. In a phone interview posted by the Nobel Committee, Dr. Yagi said, while waiting for an airplane to take off, that he grew up in a very humble home, sharing a room with the cattle his family raised. His parents could barely read or write. In a news conference hosted later by Berkeley, Dr. Yagi credited the American public university system for what he had achieved and added that getting his first grant from the National Science Foundation ultimately led to his Nobel Prize. Science, he reflected during the earlier phone interview, is the greatest equalizing force in the world. Smart people, talented people, skilled people exist everywhere, he added. During the Berkeley News Conference, he also highlighted the value of scholars coming to the U.S. from other countries, saying that the spread of knowledge often comes from people moving across regions. Science allows us to talk to each other, and I don't think you can stop that, he said. I think that's something that will continue to be important, and enlightened societies will encourage it. That story on the Nobel Prize winners in chemistry, posted by the New York Times on October 8, 2025. And from the Associated Press, also posted on October 8th. A knock at the door, a call from a strange number. Here's how the Nobel Prize winners heard they won. For some Nobel Prize winners this year, the news came with a knock at the door before dawn. For others, it was a long-awaited phone call honoring a discovery made decades ago. One of the Medicine Prize winners, meanwhile, was on vacation in Yellowstone National Park without cellular service. It would be hours before he found out. The Nobel Prizes are considered among the world's most prestigious honors for achievements in medicine, physics, chemistry, literature, economics, and peace. The winners join the pantheon of Nobel laureates, from Albert Einstein to Mother Teresa. Sometimes the award is anticipated. Potential winners plan tentative news conferences, or in the Western U.S., wait up all night for the news. While some prizes might feature household names, the natural science categories typically go to people whose names the general public doesn't know for decades-old research. Five of this year's nine science winners were in the U.S. when the news broke. Some were fast asleep. Two winners in Japan, 7 hours ahead of Stockholm, were awake and working when the call came from a Swedish number. One thought it was a telemarketer. Wednesday's chemistry prize was the first time this year that the Nobel Committee reached all three winners ahead of the formal announcement. Here's how some of the year's winners found out. Mary Bunko is in Seattle, and around 4 a.m. local time Monday, it was the scientist's dog who woke up first. Zelda's barking roused Brunko's husband. "I don't think he really knew what I was there for," Wasson said. And I said, "You know, sir, I think your wife just won the Nobel Prize." "Don't be ridiculous," she told her husband. But it was true. The trio had, in research dating back 2 decades, uncovered a key pathway the body uses to keep the immune system in check, called peripheral immune tolerance. Experts call the findings critical to understanding autoimmune diseases, such as type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. The following day, AP photographers Mark Terrill and Damien DeVarganis headed to Santa Barbara, California, to find physicist John Martinez before the sun rose. His wife, Jean, answered the door and told them to come back later, that he needed to sleep. "For many years, we would stay up on the night the physics award was announced," she told the photographers. "At some point, we just decided, that's nuts. We'll figure it out if it's happening, but we'll just get our sleep." She added, laughing, "I was trying to think how I can introduce this, like, do you think you should plan a trip to Sweden?" She finally woke her husband up just before 6 a.m. local time, telling him only that the AP wanted an interview. "I kind of knew that the Nobel Prize announcements were this past week, so I kind of put 2 and 2 together," he said later. "I opened my computer and looked under the Nobel Prize 2025 and saw my picture along with Michelle Devoret and John Clark. So I was kind of in shock." And then there was Fred Ramsdell. Everyone but Fred seemed to know that he had won the Nobel Prize in Medicine. But he was away on a backpacking trip on Monday when it was announced, driving through Yellowstone National Park with his wife and 2 dogs, Larkin and Megan. He kept his cell phone in airplane mode, as he often does on family trips. As they drove through a small town hours later, his wife started screaming as notifications flooded her phone. She told him he just won the Nobel Prize in Medicine, alongside Brunko and Shimon Sakaguchi. "I said, no, I didn't," Ramsdell told the AP in an interview the following day from his car. And she said, "Yes, you did. I have 200 text messages that say you won the Nobel Prize." Later Monday, Ramsdell drove to a Montana hotel to connect to Wi-Fi and call friends and colleagues. He didn't speak with the Nobel Committee to get their congratulations until midnight. He said he was stunned and awed to receive the recognition, but he has no plans to change his phone habits, which he says are important for work-life balance. And this year's 6 Nobel Prizes, honoring groundbreaking contributions in physiology or medicine, physics, chemistry, economic science, literature, and peace, will be awarded in Stockholm, Sweden, in December. The following articles were first broadcast on the August 31st, 2025 program. From the New York Times, the story of an incredible journey. With dams removed from the Klamath River, a group of indigenous youth is on a journey to descend the full length through Oregon and California. The article was written by John Branch, reporting from the Klamath River. It was published on June 17, 2025, and updated the next day, June 18, 2025. The remote and rugged Klamath River in Oregon and California, one of the mightiest in the American West and an ancient lifeline to indigenous tribes, is running free again, mostly for the first time in 100 years after the recent removal of 4 major dams. At the burbling aquifer near Chiloquin, Oregon, that is considered the headwaters a sacred spot for Native people, a group of kayakers, mostly indigenous youth from the river's vast basin, began to paddle on Thursday, June 12th. Ages 13 to 20, they had learned to kayak for this moment. Stroke by stroke, mile by mile, day by day, they planned to reach the salty water of the rugged Northern California coast, more than 300 miles away, by mid-July. These young Native kayakers practiced on one of the newly flowing sections of the river ahead of the expedition. This group of young kayakers represented six tribes along the Klamath River. Most of them had never been in a kayak before preparing for this expedition. If all goes as planned, the kayakers were going to pass the rehabilitated sites of the largest dam removal project in U.S. history. They would pass salmon swimming upstream in places that the fish had not been able to reach since the early 1900s. They would pass through the ancient territory of their tribes, the Klamath, Shasta, Karuk, Hoopa Valley, and Yurok among them. And when they reached the wide mouth of the river at the Pacific Ocean near Klamath, California, they planned to celebrate as the first to descend the full length of the Klamath, source to sea, since the dams went up and pinched life from the water. "I'm really excited to be on the river with friends, celebrating this huge accomplishment that our people have been fighting for forever," said Ruby Rain Williams, aged 18, of the Karuk tribe. The sky was blue. The mood was, at turns, celebratory and solemn. The colorful kayaks glided across a pool of crystal water, headed downstream. "Water flows again." An elder from the Klamath tribes blessed the expedition with the burning root of wild celery and the feathers of a hawk. Tonawan Jaden Daus, a 15-year-old from the Hoopa Valley tribe, bounced through a Class 4 rapid that didn't exist a year ago in a narrow canyon where one of the dams fell. Ruby followed, emerging from a stretch of steep white water with a wide grin. The expedition was 2 days away. Scouting the difficult section of rapids from a raft, Kia Wiki, a 17-year-old Yurok, whooped at her new friends. All three grew up along the water in different tribes, hearing stories of ancestors who could walk across the Klamath on the backs of so many salmon. Today, everyone was more likely to get dinner from a local convenience store than from the river. The arrival of white settlers, starting with a group of beaver trappers in 1826, interrupted the rhythms of life here for the next 200 years. Gold miners and timber companies came. Farmers and ranchers arrived, sucking and diverting water from the river and draining the fish-rich wetlands near the headlands, the headwaters. The first hydroelectric dam, COPCO 1, named for the California-Oregon Power Company, was built in 1918. Others followed: COPCO 2 in 1925, J.C. Boyle in 1958, and Iron Gate in 1964. They were 400 vertical feet of water stoppers and lake makers within a 45-mile stretch straddling the Oregon-California border. Salmon had no way to get through. For decades, tribes and environmentalists, seeing and feeling an ecological and cultural disaster unfold, demanded the removal of dams and the restoration of the river. Voices went largely unheard until 2002, when tens of thousands of dead salmon and steelhead trout washed up on the lower banks of the river. The dam removal movement gained momentum, and politicians and other power brokers slowly acknowledged that the relatively low amounts of power generated by the dams in such a rural region was not enough reason to continue suffocating the river and its tributaries. In small creeks that feed into the upper Klamath, Hundreds of miles from the ocean, salmon were spotted 11 days after the last dam fell last fall in 2024. By then, a small group of river runners, having recruited and extensively trained about three dozen indigenous teens growing up along the Klamath, had grand plans to be the first group to paddle the length of the freed river. Two smaller dams remain, upriver from the dismantled ones and not far from the headwaters. The paddlers had to portage around the dams. The tribes would like those dams gone as well. "Then all of our relatives can be connected again," said William Ray, Jr., the chairman of the Klamath Tribes, a consortium of the Klamath, Modoc, and Yahuskin people. On Tuesday, June 10th, some of those teens, preparing for the expedition and practicing their skills, paddled through a section that had been the floor of Kopko Lake for more than a century. They could see the fading shoreline of the old lake as the river found its old course. "Water has memory," tribal elders say. The Klamath River has been the lifeblood of tribes for thousands of years. Current generations know the river for its decline, largely from dams, and as a place to swim. On Riffling Current, the paddlers passed houses that had stood lakeside for decades, now sitting far from the river's edge, their old docks leading nowhere. They passed a graveyard of bald trees, still standing, that had been submerged for years. A boat anchor hung, tangled, on one of the naked gray limbs. Entering Kigachiki Canyon, they passed the site of Kopko 1. Almost all signs of the massive structure have been removed. This year's river runners might not realize it had been there just last summer. A few miles downriver, Kopko 2 once diverted all of the water out of the canyon, through tunnels and pipes, to a power station, where the water re-entered. For generations, the dam left a surreal dry stretch of riverbed in the heart of a twisting walled canyon lined by extraordinary columnar basalt formations. Alders and cottonwoods overtook the dry channel, threatening to clog the natural river route. Part of the restoration plan meant cutting down about 1,000 of the trees and airlifting them out of the canyon by helicopter. Now the river that had carved the stone canyon runs wild again. The teens looked up in wonder, and then they put their heads down and paddled. The team expected to reach the Pacific Ocean in mid-July. This would be after a 310-mile expedition that began not far from Crater Lake in Oregon, near the headwaters of the Klamath River Basin. Rush Sturges, 40, is a professional kayaker and filmmaker who grew up on California's Salmon River, a tributary of the Klamath. His parents ran a kayak school for 40 years. Mr. Sturges knew all about the fight to remove the dams. "But," he said, "I didn't know a single indigenous kayaker before this." In 2021, he met Weston Boyles, aged 38, the founder and executive director of Rios to Rivers, a global organization advocating indigenous youth and rivers around the world through education and exchange programs. They discussed life after the dams. "Shouldn't Native children be the first to paddle the full stretch of the reflowing river?" they asked themselves. And thus, the organization Paddle Tribal Waters was born. It soon recruited Danielle Frank, a 21-year-old Hoopa Valley tribe member known as Ducky, and a dynamo of activism and advocacy work in the Klamath Basin. She helped connect the organizers to the tribes. Despite deep and ancient connections to the river, most Native people along the Klamath had never been in a kayak. Kayaks were something that floated by, holding outsiders. White water was something to fear, not enjoy. "Recreation is a luxury that wasn't afforded to us," said John Acuna, 30, also a member of the Hoopa Valley tribe. 3 years after being introduced to kayaking, 3 years after being introduced to kayaking, He became a certified instructor and a leader on the expedition. "We have an opportunity to redefine what our relationship to the river is," he said. The long-term plan for Paddle Tribal Waters is to connect children to the rejuvenated river. Some students, like Jaden, one of the most talented kayakers I've ever seen learn the sport, Mr. Sturgis said, have organized kayak clubs in their tribes. The short-term plan was less philosophical. "We wanted to train these kids to lead this first descent," Mr. Sturgis said. With stretches that include technical and dangerous Class 4 rapids, Class 6 is not navigable. The Klamath is not for novices. So Paddle Tribal Waters ran multi-week summer programs in 2022, 2023, and 2024, teaching 45 teens how to paddle whitewater. At night, they took tribe-led classes on activism, ecosystems, and cultural knowledge. Some then took part in semester-long school and paddle programs around the world. About 14 youth and 7 staff members planned to paddle the entire stretch of river. Another 30 or so teens planned to join the party midway. They planned to camp on the river's banks. And there would also be ceremonial meetings and meals with tribal members and families. Food and gear would be shuttled in at various access points, part of a coordinated and complex logistical challenge. Along the way, the young kayakers would be encouraged to help name rapids, maybe in native languages, so that the many commercial outfits that run the river in rafts and kayaks might adopt them. The group was scheduled to arrive at the Pacific Ocean ahead of a large-scale celebration on July 12th, and a symposium the next day. But that was still 300 miles and 30 days away. Scarlett Schroeder, 13, and Coley Miller, 14, who belonged to tribes on the Upper Klamath, daydreamed about reaching the ocean. "We're definitely going to go down in history," Scarlett said. "Our grandkids will know," Coley said. "Our great-great-great-grandkids will know," Scarlett said. On Thursday, June 12th at noon, at the headwaters near Chiloquin, Oregon, not far from Crater Lake National Park, the kayakers and supporters gathered in a circle near the water's edge. Leaders from the Klamath tribes took turns explaining the significance of the sacred journey. Many wore shirts that read, "Undamned." One wore a hat that read, "Make American Native Again." One leader told the group that she was nervous for the group to go, but knew that the paddlers were brave. A water song was sung. The smoking root of wild celery was passed and spread around the body of each paddler. Not all of the expedition would be rugged whitewater. The early days of the journey meant crossing Upper Klamath Lake and portaging around the 2 remaining dams on the river. Soon, the kayakers were sitting low in their colorful boats and pointed toward the open water. Jeff Mitchell, a former chairman of the Klamath tribes, leaned against a pine tree, holding a walking stick in one hand, an eagle wing in the other. He had not known he would see this day. "Think of all the Yurok, Hoopa, Karuk, and Klamath people who worked on this for the last 30 years," he said. "It's amazing." A young couple wandered up, curious about what was going to happen. Mr. Mitchell explained the expedition, the dams coming down, the meaning of it all. "You're witnessing the first descent from the headwaters to the ocean," he said. The pair listened and nodded, and Mr. Miller smiled. On that Thursday, June 12th, the kayakers gathered in a circle in the water. They let out a collective shout, and then they began to paddle away. Soon they disappeared around the bend, headed for history. And on July 11th, 120 kayakers made history. As reported in the _Native News, Indigenous youth complete 310-mile Klamath River journey. The youth descended a free-flowing Klamath River after the biggest dam removal project in history. And the photo shows the 120 youth kayakers representing the Klamath, Yurok, Karuk, Quartz Valley, Hoopa Valley, Warm Springs, as well as the Tohono O'odham Nation, completing their historic 310-mile descent of the free-flowing Klamath River, culminating the largest dam removal project in history. And it is an amazing photo. There is fog on the river, and it's almost as if they are all paddling in sync. Over 100 family and community members gathered on the sand spit shore below Requa Village on the Yurok Reservation, where the Klamath River meets the Pacific Ocean, to welcome 120 Indigenous youth kayakers over that last 30 days, making history as the first people to descend over 310 miles down the free-flowing Klamath River. "This is an historical moment for us," said Susan Mastin, former Yurok Tribal Chair, past president of the National Congress of American Indians, and the president and co-founder of Women Empowering Women for Indian Nations. "We haven't had the opportunity yet to celebrate the dams coming down as a people. This moment in time with these youth that have traveled 30 days, the river has guided them down to us," said Mastin. It was a foggy morning as Mastin stood on the beach, eagerly awaiting to welcome her niece and the other kayakers. For more than a century, four hydroelectric dams blocked the Klamath, disrupting once abundant salmon runs and disconnecting Indigenous communities from the river that they have lived along since time immemorial. The last of those dams were removed in the fall of last year, marking the completion of the largest dam removal project in history. "The most significant and important thing about it is that the river is healing," said Mastin. "The river remembers," she added. "The fish are coming back to spawn where they haven't been able to be in 100+ years. The fish remember. We, as this river system, are healing." On June 12th, the kayakers began their journey. They made the long-awaited dream of the Klamath Basin tribes a reality once they entered the mouth of the river. "There have been generations of individuals and tribes who have been fighting this fight," said Mastin. "Our ancestors have provided safety for them on their journey. We are just excited and want them to feel like we are honoring them because they have provided international and national attention to our river and the importance of having a free-flowing river. They have inspired millions to be advocating and fighting for their own rivers and their homelands." More than 3 years of preparation led to this moment, as youth traveled to places like Chile, Costa Rica, Canada, and Africa to train and learn how to navigate whitewater with kayak instructors from the Paddle Tribal Waters Program, part of the nonprofit Rios to Rivers. As mothers helped their children dress into traditional Yurok regalia, deerskin skirts adorned with rows of abalone and shells, placing Yurok hat baskets atop their heads, and more, the sound of drums and songs blended with the cheers of those on shore as the bright neon-colored kayaks emerged from the fog, led by two traditional redwood dugout canoes. "I look up and I see so many family members there, and so many community members, and my grandparents and everybody, and someone who's like my uncle singing his song and drumming for us. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're actually about to finish this. We actually did it," said Danielle Frank, Hoopa tribal member and Yurok descendant, director of development and community relations for Rios to Rivers. "It felt very scenic and very deep," said Frank. "Like the river and the world was having this deep moment, welcoming us into this historic time and place." Smiles lit the faces of the kayakers as they reached the shore. They immediately jumped from their kayaks and sprinted through the lines of cheering people to the crashing waves of the Pacific Ocean. It's just a big moment in history and in everybody's lives, said 20-year-old Iskots Zoyan Scott of the Hoopa Valley Tribe as she tried to catch her breath after celebrating in the ocean with the others. All of our families have been fighting for dam removal. Everybody's been fighting for us to be able to reach different parts of the river that we haven't been able to in over 150 years. So it's really so much. I can't even explain how I feel right now. On the beach, one elder was overcome with emotion watching the youth kayakers. She apologized to the people standing next to her. They told her that, "No, we can cry, Grandma. Crying is part of it. Crying is healing." After the landing, everyone jumped in kayaks, rafts, and boats to join tribal elders, community members, and family at the boat dock for a celebration. Youth and representatives took turns sharing about their experiences. "It's not just a river trip, and it's not just a descent to us," said Frank in her speech. "This whole trip is really a letter to our community. It's a letter of love, the love that has been shown to us our entire lives, the love we get to show to each other and ourselves that was wrapped into this trip. That's what built this trip, was knowing that we were loved enough to be supported to do something like this." "It's also a letter of promise," Frank continued. "We promise that we will do whatever we have to protect our free-flowing river now." And the reporter of this story, Jarette Work, _Native News, is a multimedia journalist with experience in digital news, audio reporting, and photojournalism. He joined Underscore in June 2022 in partnership with the National Report for America program. The story of these kayakers is a gripping story. In our next article, we learn about the power of storytelling. Good storytellers are more likely to have a sense of purpose and to see the big picture, says Ron Shachar, who writes this article that appeared in the June 2025 issue of Scientific American in Mind Matters. He writes, "King Shahryar, betrayed by his wife, decides to marry a new woman each night and have her executed by morning to ensure he is never deceived again. After Scheherazade volunteers to marry the king, she outsmarts him. She begins a gripping story every evening but stops telling it at dawn, leaving her husband eager for more. Night after night, she keeps him hooked with new tales, and over the course of 1,001 nights, he falls in love with her and abandons his cruel ways. This story is the frame of 1,001 Nights, a medieval collection of Middle Eastern folk tales, including the stories of Aladdin, Ali Baba, and Sinbad, that highlight the power of storytelling. But can storytelling skills indeed save a person's life in the real world? The findings of recent research by my colleagues and me don't go that far yet, but they do show that strong storytelling skills can dramatically improve someone's well-being. This result hints that, yes, skillful storytellers may actually live longer. How exactly? You'll have to wait until the end of this story to find out. No peeking. Our journey starts with extensive research on narrative identity, showing that people make sense of who they are by shaping their life experiences into a story, one that gives their life meaning. The idea is that by connecting our experiences, we can recognize the guiding force that has shaped our journey. For instance, the belief that we like helping people, and in turn, uncover our sense of purpose and meaning in life. In our research, my colleagues and I shift the focus from stories, particularly life stories, to storytelling. We suggest that compared with others, skillful storytellers have a stronger sense of meaning in life and approach their experiences with what we call a why mindset. That is, they focus on their reasons for doing what they do, rather than just on how they do it. Our hypothesis about storytellers is rooted in the nature of stories. The typical narrative focuses on a hero who strives to achieve a goal, such as landing a job or winning someone's heart, while facing various obstacles and challenges along the way. Therefore, to excel at storytelling, individuals must develop two key skills. First, they need to connect the dots, the events of the story, in a meaningful way to create a coherent narrative. Secondly, they must learn to see the world through the eyes of their characters, understanding the why of what drives people. In applying these two skills to their own lives, talented storytellers use the first to identify and pursue what gives their life meaning, and the second to foster a mindset that prioritizes the why behind their actions over the how. To illustrate this point, let's imagine two people, Rachel and Monica. Both had the same career path, and both worked in multiple vastly different industries, including sports, medicine, and banking. Throughout their careers, they often acted on impulse. Rachel is a skillful storyteller, however, and Monica isn't. This difference comes across vividly when they reflect on their careers. Monica is more likely to feel lost and to lack clarity about her sense of meaning and purpose in life because she doesn't possess a why mindset, having always focused on how to get things done rather than the bigger picture. Rachel, in contrast, is inclined to reflect more deeply on her life and see connections, such as the fact that in all her managerial jobs, she used her position to bolster the presence of women in decision-making roles. This observation gives her a sense of purpose and a deeper understanding of what drives her, that is, her why. But this story is just hypothetical. Does it pan out in real life? To examine how a skill for narrative serves storytellers, we conducted 5 studies with about 800 participants. To reliably measure storytelling ability, we took a multifaceted approach. First, we developed and tested a questionnaire in which we asked people how much they agreed with statements such as, "My stories usually excite my listeners." Secondly, we interviewed close friends of the participants about their storytelling skills. Third, we invited trios of strangers to our laboratory and asked them to share stories with one another. In our lab experiment, each participant told 2 distinct stories, one about a personal trait and one that incorporated 3 random words we provided, a task designed to isolate the core mechanics of storytelling. This approach is a significant departure from previous studies of life stories. Here, we are really homing in on the ability to craft a compelling narrative from minimal material. As part of the experiment, each participant rated the storytelling ability of the others in their trio, and afterward, storytelling experts, people who had just completed a course on the subject, reviewed video recordings of the sessions and provided independent ratings. Thus, we had 4 measures of storytelling skill. 1, people's self-reports of their own ability. 2, opinions of close friends. 3, ratings from other members of the trio in our lab experiment. And 4, evaluations from storytelling experts. In addition to these assessments, we asked participants questions to get a sense of how meaningful they found life and whether they approached decisions with a why mindset rather than a how mindset. Across all studies and measures, we consistently found that storytelling ability is linked to both a sense of meaning in life and a mindset focused on the whys. When we tested whether personality traits might be driving our findings, we found they weren't. That said, personality did add interesting nuance. People who are naturally open to new experiences tend to be better storytellers, for example. That makes sense. Such people are more likely to be part of unique and interesting events that lend themselves to great stories, and these encounters give these individuals more opportunities to refine their storytelling skills as they share their experiences with others. We also found that storytelling skills related to meaning in life for introverts more than they did for extroverts. In general, extroverts have a stronger sense of meaning in life, but storytelling may help introverts compensate for that difference. Both storytelling and extroversion are related to expressiveness. Extroversion is all about the urge to express yourself in social settings, whereas storytelling is about having a knack for doing so through stories. It turns out that either one of these tendencies can be enough to spark a sense of meaning and purpose. This work offers several lessons. First, because people with a why mindset, by definition, excel at seeing the big picture, our findings suggest that the abilities to tell stories well and to see the big picture are closely related. Although seeing the big picture is useful in its own right, it may also be a crucial advantage that humans have over artificial intelligence, which excels at executing microtasks. Thus, when we are facing an uncertain future, our ability to tell stories is something we should treasure and cultivate. My team's findings also suggest that storytelling workshops, which have grown popular in recent years, influence people's lives in ways that go beyond improving communication and persuasion. They may strengthen the driving force of our existence and sharpen our sense of direction in life. The benefits of cultivating greater purpose are many, and some of them are unexpected. Past research has found that a strong sense of meaning in life is associated with many health benefits, including a longer lifespan. Combined with our findings, this outcome suggests that storytelling may also contribute to better health and decreased mortality. Plus, storytelling helps people connect, which can naturally expand their social circles. Because strong social relationships are known to boost health and even influence longevity, it makes sense that storytelling could indirectly support physical health by fostering deeper and broader social ties. Perhaps 1001 Nights was correct all along. Storytelling may help to save your life. Roy Shachar is a professor of economics and business at Reichman University in Israel. He studies storytelling, big picture thinking, branding, advertising, and political campaigns. His article on the power of storytelling appears in the June 2025 issue of Scientific American. And finally, a book review from the June 2025 issue of Science News. Why Silly Science is Valuable by Karen Kwan. The review is of The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog, written by Carly Ann York, published by Basic Books. What's the purpose of your study? It's the question many basic science researchers dread, and it's one that Carly Ann York received about 10 years ago as a PhD student studying squid biomechanics. When a fellow Virginia Zoo volunteer, a retired Army officer, probed why taxpayer dollars should be spent on silly science, quote-unquote, all York could do was mutter about the inherent value of knowledge. Today, York, an animal physiologist at Lenoir Rhine University in Hickory, North Carolina, recognizes that immediate application is not the goal of basic science. Rather, it seeks to fundamentally understand natural phenomena. That doesn't mean the research is worthless. As York details in her book, The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog, projects that could seem silly or useless can unwittingly lead to scientific advances that better our lives. Take sea fireflies. Studying the tiny crustacean's mysterious glow had been considered difficult and unpredictable. But in 1956, Japanese chemist Osamu Shimomura isolated a molecule behind the phenomenon. That feat attracted the attention of a U.S. researcher who recruited Shimomura to help study luminescent jellyfish. The team uncovered two proteins responsible for the jellyfish's glow, a quorin and a green fluorescent protein. The groundbreaking work revolutionized biological research and medicine. Doctors now use green fluorescent protein to better visualize and avoid nerves during surgery, as well as to track the spread of cancer cells in the body. The discovery earned Shimomura the 2008 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. The book reminds us that it's impossible to predict the path and outcome of basic science projects. It is an especially timely reminder as the U.S. government cuts science funding today. And Karen Kwan's review of The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog, written by Carly Ann York, appears in the June 2025 issue of Science News. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.